Saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he.
Funds were low. 1,300 people were on strike, and the union's back was against the wall. And so it was that in the tradition of the words of the song written about Joe Hill, a union activist and writer of songs and poetry who was framed and executed in Salt Lake City, that Paul Robeson came to the side of working men and women on strike.
That was the first time that I realized that laws were made in the main sometimes to handcuff those who they feel are powerless. So I had to talk with them about going out on strike in order to force the governor to comply with the law. So I had to break the law to force him to comply.
Blood Runs Cold is a story about the most infamous crimes in American labor history, the triple murders of United Mine Workers of America reformer Joseph Jock Jablonski, his wife and daughter, during the early morning hours of New Year's Eve, 1969. This story has Shakespearean dimensions because it's a tale of extraordinary courage, unspeakable savagery, and blood-soaked redemption.
The year was 1971. That was the day that Namibian workers began a general strike to protest the contract labor system.
95% of DC's hotel and restaurant workers are now out of work and have been for months because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Their struggles to survive prompted Saul Schneiderman, a regular contributor to Labor History Today, to delve into the archives of Talking Union magazine for the inspiring story of how cafeteria workers at the Library of Congress first organized a union, and how legendary singer and activist Paul Robeson played a key role in that battle. On this week's show, we'll also hear from Lillian Roberts, an African-American woman from Chicago who was an organizer for the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees in New York State. She was jailed for a month in December 1968 after she led a series of strikes at New York State hospitals to protest Governor Nelson Rockefeller's opposition to unionization. The brutal murder in 1968 of Jock Jablonski and his family by United Mine Workers President Tony Boyle sent shockwaves through the labor movement. Its impact inspired a surge in union democracy across labor's ranks. The Heartland Labor Forum, Kansas City's only program about the workplace, talked about it with Mark Bradley, author of the book Blood Runs Cold. And on this week's Labor History in 2, Rick Smith tells us about the beginning of the end of apartheid. I'm Chris Garlock, and that's all ahead on this week's Labor History Today. I hope you enjoy the show.
During the 1980s, I edited Talkin' Union, which was a labor folklore magazine. And in going through some old files recently, I found a local history written by Marcella Pope. Ms. Pope was well known in the District of Columbia labor movement, and she used to work at the United Labor Agency here in D.C., which is now the Community Services Agency, affiliated with our Central Labor Council, AFL-CIO. And the title of her letter, which is actually a local history narrative, was called The Cafeteria Workers Organize a Union by Marcella Pope. Cafeteria employees who organized themselves into United Cafeteria Workers most assuredly made a significant and outstanding contribution in the development of Black history within the local Washington, D.C. labor movement. The union came into existence during the mid-1930s after the late Oliver T. Palmer, a former member of Local 415 of the International Hod Carriers and Common Laborers Union, moved to D.C. from Atlantic City and went to work in a federal government cafeteria. There, he found far from ideal working conditions, which included an hourly wage rate of 25 cents. Since this was an intolerable situation, he was soon in contact with co-workers who were anxious to better their plight. Prominent among these co-workers was a Mrs. Rosa Lewis, who with Palmer led the initial drive for a union and later became fondly known as the Mother of the Union. The initial group banded together, and after many meetings, most of which were held in the auditorium of the Garnett Patterson Junior High School at 10th and U Streets Northwest, the small, unorganized, underpaid, and overworked cafeteria workers, the majority of whom were women, became a full-fledged certified labor organization. A contract was signed with the United Cafeteria Workers and the Welfare and Recreation Association. Years later, this group became employees in what we now know as the Government Services Incorporated. The leaders of this new union, dedicated to the principle of organizing the unorganized, began to sign up as many members as possible within the jurisdiction of the Welfare and Recreation Association. Organizing the unorganized was also the union's insurance against union-breaking tactics as practiced by management. As a result, collective bargaining agreements were signed with food service operations at the Pentagon, the Washington Navy Yard, and the Department of Agriculture. Agreements were also signed with private sector food services. After the merger of the CIO, with which the cafeteria workers were affiliated, and the AFL, the United Cafeteria and Restaurant Workers became Cafeteria and Restaurant Workers, Local 471 AFL-CIO. Now, the leaders of this union were also believers in the principle that their presence should be felt within the community in areas other than that of organizing on the job. The economic struggle they felt must be combined with the struggle for civil rights and human dignity. So they were active participants in the drive to rid the city of police brutality, which was consistently practiced against its black residents, helped picket People's Drugstore and the Thompson Restaurant, where black patronage was solicited and welcomed throughout the store, with the exception of the lunch counter. Lifetime members of the NAACP and active participants on the March on Washington. The union's buildings, first at 1015 M Street and later at 1438 U Street Northwest, were always open to groups working for a better District of Columbia. Another positive aspect was strengthened the union's ties with the community and served them well during the 1940s and the 50s and the 60s was their connections with the religious community, Shiloh Baptist Church and Vermont Avenue Baptist Church, come to mind as the setting for many of Local 471 strike sanction meetings to report on negotiations and to ratify contracts. It was in 1948 that the union experienced its most distressful period when 1,300 members were forced into the streets by Government Services, Inc. for a period of 79 very cold and bitter winter days. The workers were despaired and crushed down, not because they did not believe in their cause, but because of real life-threatening reasons. To quote Oliver T. Palmer, funds were low, 1,300 people were on strike, and the union's back was against the wall. And so it was that in the tradition of the words of the song written about Joe Hill, a union activist and writer of songs and poetry, who was framed and executed in Salt Lake City, that Paul Robeson came to the side of working men and women on strike. He came to the nation's capital at his own expense, and in a concert he lifted that magnificent, big booming voice in songs of free people, of working people in struggle, of songs which told of his unwavering love for all humanity, in songs which cried out against injustice and exploitation. And he did it all in love for a small group of low-paid food service workers that they might walk in dignity and sit down at a table and bargain for a living wage. All of the proceeds of that concert, together with Paul's own $5,000 contribution, went to those striking men and women, and as a result, the cafeteria workers grew and began to make its presence felt wherever and whenever there was the need. With Paul Robeson as their example, they were ever eager to join forces with and lend support to other workers who had nothing to sell but their labor as they carried on their day-to-day struggle in the economic and political arena. In the ensuing years, the United Cafeteria and Restaurant Workers have taken great forward steps from their early beginnings of 25 cents average hourly wage, long hours, no paid vacations or holidays, no on-the-job dignity, to mention just a few of the terrible indignities suffered in their workplaces. Today, the union, the majority of its members still women, but including women of all races and nationalities, is a vital part of Local 25, the hotel and restaurant employees, now the second largest union in the metropolitan Washington area. Thank you to Marcella Pope for writing this wonderful narrative.
Lillian Roberts came to New York in 1965 during a peak in labor militancy led by state and municipal government employees. Teachers, social workers, and sanitation workers all fought for better working conditions, improved pay scales, and reformed social services. Roberts, an African-American woman from Chicago, was an organizer for the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, AFSCME, and helped AFSCME's Local District 37 win the right to represent thousands of hospital employees. She led a series of strikes at New York State hospitals to protest Governor Nelson Rockefeller's opposition to unionization. Her efforts landed her in jail for a month, where she found it hard, despite gestures of solidarity from her fellow prisoners. Roberts was arrested on December 14, 1968, for organizing an illegal strike by New York State employees. She was sentenced to 30 days, but released after 11 on Christmas Eve. AFSCME ultimately won the strike. Here's Lillian Roberts in her own words.
The governor, who was Rockefeller at that time, under the Taylor Law, had given the representation to the Civil Service Employees Association, which was an insurance company. And he said that they represented the workers and therefore they would have time to do their bargaining and maybe we would have an election later on. This is one big unit of which we objected to, because the law clearly said that there would be units, and then of course he had none and he was bargaining with them. So my international union asked me if I would go in and organize the institutional unit to organize the institutional workers, because we were strong in that area. So I started to get enough numbers together so that we could challenge them. And of course the governor, we said he was wrong, because Governor Rockefeller was wrong, that he had no right to hand over these workers and they had a right, of course, to have an election. And he ignored us. And I was steady signing people up and drafting a program, which I drafted a similar program that I had for them, career development, and all the things that we had had in the city. And they were always lagging behind in terms of their wages anyway. We must have had that drive for about 4 or 5 months, and we just couldn't get him to budge. So I had to talk with them about going out on strike in order to force the governor to comply with the law. So I had to break the law to force him to comply. And that was the first time that I realized that laws were made in the main sometimes to handcuff those who they feel are powerless. And so I talked to the workers and we went out on strike. Creedmoor was the first place. We were very successful with them. Even the patients was helping us. It was just wonderful, the spirit that was there. We went to Bronx State, and we were going to go to Manhattan State, and they wanted to know which hospital was next, and part of our strategy was not to tell them. Whenever the president of that institution felt he was ready, he let me know hours ahead of time, then he'd go, and then, of course, we'd be there for him. We created quite an inconvenience. They'd have to move those patients that really needed that lockup to other institutions, and by them not knowing where we were going, it was like driving them crazy, you know. So we called it a roving strike. As a result of that, they was looking for me, and I guess I looked like all the workers because I was on the line the same as they were. Finally, they caught up with me, and I think they expected to lock up Jerry Wirth because this was under state jurisdiction, really not under Victor Gottbaum's jurisdiction. And so Jerry did not show up in court, so they locked me up. I guess they thought I'd be afraid of it, but I was not. You know, I was so tired. I just wanted a place to sleep, you know.
Did you have a meeting or discuss this with Jerry Wirth about?
Well, he had mentioned to me that, you know, you might go to jail. I said, so? You know, it was for a month. That's the maximum sentence they could give you. So they gave me the month. If I was organizing, then I felt that nobody should take my place. After all, if you're a woman and you're out there and you're working, you don't want to be treated differently. So I stood my ground. I was the only one there in court, and I'm the one who went to jail. And it was a very demeaning experience for me. It was a civil jail where they had material witnesses and people who were waiting to go to court for some reason, immigrants waiting to be deported, gang members, you know, who were going to testify and so on. But at that time, it being a holiday, after a couple of days, I was the only prisoner, only female prisoner. And you didn't have heat on the weekend because most people were out, and it was very cold. But I must say that the different prisoners realized that my fight was their fight, so they sneak in and send heat up at least once.
Good evening, and welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm your host, Michael Savoie. Our show tonight is an interview with the author of Blood Runs Cold, a gripping story of the 1968 murders of Jacques Wabanski and his family by United Mine Workers President Tony Ball and its impact on the American labor movement. The author, Mark Bradley, is the Director of Information Security Oversight Office at the National Archives and Records Administration. A former Justice Department lawyer, he holds a master's degree in modern history from Oxford and a law degree from the University of Virginia. Good evening, Mark. Thank you for joining us on the Heartland Labor Forum. How are you?
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure, Michael.
Indeed. Mark, I was really impressed with your work. It really read like a Toni Morrison novel rather than a chronicle of labor history. What motivated your interest in this 50-year-old rivalry? What were your goals?
It was such an extraordinary story. If you want, Michael, I can go into a brief overview of the book, and then maybe we can return to some questions. Would that be okay?
Yeah, that's fine.
Thanks, Michael. Again, I really appreciate this opportunity and want to thank you and Heartland Labor Forum for having me on this evening and giving me such a great venue to talk about my book. I really appreciate it. Blood Runs Cold is a story about the most infamous crimes in American labor history, the triple murders of United Mine Workers of America reformer Joseph Jacques Jablonski, his wife and daughter, during the early morning hours of New Year's Eve, 1969. My book focuses not only on the killings and why and how they took place, but also what happened after them, especially the FBI's hunt for the family's killers, their trials, and what became the first successful rank-and-file takeover of a major labor union in our country's history when Jacques Jablonski's followers were finally able to take over the UMWA in 1972. To me, this story has Shakespearean dimensions because it's a tale of extraordinary courage, unspeakable savagery, and blood-soaked redemption. 1969, UMWA was the richest union in the United States, a time when roughly one-third of the country's non-agricultural workers belonged to labor unions. It was also among the least democratic, a tradition that started with John L. Lewis in the early 1920s. In 1969, it was ruled by W.A. Tony Boyle, an iron-fisted dictator from Montana who used the union's treasury as a personal piggy bank, turned his back on the safety of his miners, and who was in the hip pocket of the coal operators. Boyle's rule might have gone on indefinitely, but for a catastrophic explosion on November 20, 1968, in a West Virginia coal mine that killed 78 union miners. His defense of the coal mine's owners' outrageously neglectful safety practices while 78 of his union members lay trapped inside its burning tunnels drew national attention, including that of safety crusader Ralph Nader. Nader realized safety in the mines was impossible as long as Tony Boyle remained the UMWA's president, In May 1969, 6 months after the explosion, Nader convinced Jock Jablonski to oppose Boyle in that year's UMWA presidential election. Jablonski, a longtime union insider and a member of its international executive board, was enraged by how far the UMWA had declined under Boyle's rule. Still, he was not without reservations. He prophetically told Nader that his bid for the union's highest office would likely cost him his life. He was right. June 23, 1969, Boyle ordered two of his henchmen to oversee Jablonski's execution, as he considered Jablonski to be a traitor. It took the killers 8 attempts between October and December 1969 to finally corner and kill Jablonski. Tragically, they were able to do that in Jablonski's farmhouse in Clarksville, Pennsylvania on New Year's Eve 1969. Their victims included not only Jablonski, but Margaret, his playwright wife, and Charlotte, the 25-year-old daughter who was a social worker. The killings triggered one of the biggest manhunts in the FBI's history and led to the formation of what became known as the Miners for Democracy, an organization made up of Jablonski's followers and led by his two lawyer sons, Chip and Kenneth, and Arnold Miller, who successfully ousted Tony Boyle in 1972 after a special election overseen by the U.S. Department of Labor. Reforms Miller instituted transformed the UMWA into what was probably then the country's most democratically run major labor union. Although my book ends on a redemptive note, it underscores the awful price democracy sometimes demands. Thank you, Mark.
Indeed. Yeah, Mark, let me ask, what motivated your interest in this 50-year-old story? For me, it was certainly, I was 21 years old then, and I remember well. But well, what motivated
you? I was 13 when it happened, Michael, and anybody who grew up in the 1960s, if you remembered anything about that decade, it was how common political assassinations were. And this one was the very last one in a decade that was filled with them. And I remembered it well. And I remember my mother comes from Kentucky, and we had some coal miners in the family. And I remember discussions about it, just again how awful it was, not only that Jablonski was killed, but also his wife and daughter. So anyway, fast forward, back in 2014, I was finishing up my first book and was up at the Library of Congress and noticed that they had gotten in 26 boxes on something called the Joseph A. Jablonski Legal Case Collection. And I looked at those boxes and realized what they were. They were the government's investigation and prosecution of Jablonski's killers. And so I went back home and looked up what had been written about the murders and realized nothing had been written about them in 50 years. So I thought it was time to revive people's memories of these killings and also revive people's memories about a different time in American history when labor unions really were major players in our country. And so it was just a combination of my love of history and also the story was so powerful that Jablonski knew he was going to likely die. He wasn't going to make it, but he was going to go ahead anyway to try to restore the union to what it had once been. So it had all sorts of angles. It had the legal angle because I'm a lawyer. It had the historical angle. And it also had the dramatic angle to it. There was nothing about this story that wasn't compelling.
Yeah. From my perspective, Mark, it certainly was one of the most significant events in labor history, and in my lifetime at least, because it inspired such a surge in union democracy. In fact, you could probably trace my activism in labor back to Jablonski because it had a profound impact on my union, that is International Brotherhood of Teamsters, and my involvement in that. Could you speak to how this event motivated other unions, the desire for union democracy across the ranks?
Sure, I'd be glad to. First of all, when the killings took place, they were front page news in this country for a long time. The killings took place again on New Year's Eve 1969. The bodies were found on January 5th, and then they were on the front page of the papers for the next 4 years as the government relentlessly hunted down the killers, including Tony Boyle, and prosecuted them. And that Klieg light, or that exposure, got people to thinking about unions in a way that they never had before. They were important, but nobody really understood the inner workings of them and how ossified some of them were. And Jablonski's murder and the victory of the Miners for Democracy in 1972, it made workers in other unions realize that they too could change or challenge their unions, the hierarchy that was often running these great organizations. And so the first one was in 1974 with Ed Sedlowski, second-generation steelworker, one especially supervised election by the federal government to become the president of District 31, which is up in Chicago, which was the United Steelworkers of America's largest district. And then, as you know yourself, Michael, 1976 marked the formation of Teamsters for Democratic Union, the TDU. But it took them 15 years and the intervention of the Department of Justice to finally bring the Teamsters their first Democratic election in decades in 1991. So, no, the Yablonski murders were inspirational. They made people realize that they could use the courts, that they could turn to the federal government for help and begin to reform and change these unions, because people often forget, and I lament this all the time, that labor history is really not taught anymore in this country. It just isn't. You really have to dig around for a history course, even in our better schools. You might find them at Wayne State, you might find them at Pitt, maybe up at Carnegie Mellon, but by and large, you can't find labor history. And people forget how important unions were. They gave us 8-hour workday. They gave us work safety. They gave us pensions. They were just so critical to the way this country, or the things that we now take for granted. And it was critical, though, that they represent their own workers as well. And the Yablonski murders, as awful as they were, and they were absolutely horrific, there was some good that came out of them.
Absolutely, Mark, and as you speak, it just brings to my mind how, indeed, it even made the Department of Justice get off the pot, in a sense. They'd been sitting on it a long time. They virtually had ignored labor. In fact, the book well documents Yablonski's plea for help and
right.
Just how they just steadfastly ignored him.
No, I mean, go ahead, Michael.
No, I was going to ask, in addition to the Teamsters was certainly inspired by that work, the United Steelworkers War Association for Union Democracy comes to mind. I think the work of Herman Benson was directly related to this. Ralph Nader and Arthur Fox with Public Citizen comes to mind. It was just a shot in the arm for union democracy, man, and we're certainly happy because of that. I went on to become, as a Teamster activist, man, I got involved with Teamsters for Democratic Union, perhaps, and served 30-plus years in working that organization. But tell me this, Mark, can anything good be said about the old strong man with the iron fist and running the union like John L. Lewis did?
Yeah. You raise a very interesting point, Michael. You've got to remember the environment these unions were coming up in, especially in the 30s and 40s. There's those who say that the union wouldn't have been as strong without a John L. Lewis and the dictatorial ways. There's a great quote in my book. One of the miners says, things are too dangerous in the union, or we have too many enemies to be democratic, that we've got to be united. So it's a fascinating question. That the thing that interested me was that Lewis stepped down in 1960. And you had the civil rights movement begin to blossom in the 1960s along with the anti-war protest. And it's almost as if these unions were tone deaf to what was going on in the country. I mean, you had George Meany in his 80s who was supporting the Vietnam War. You had a disconnect between what was happening in the rest of the country and what was happening inside organized labor. Because Yablonski stands up in 1969. You've got Richard Nixon in the White House. The civil rights movement's beginning to wane, but that's how long it took for these seeds to take root, because the strong men had been so strong that they ruled the unions in a way where it was united or not. And if you didn't fall in line, then you were in trouble. So it's a fascinating historical question.
Yes. There's no question that labor has lost its class consciousness. I speak quite often about we're working class. We're not middle class. We're working class, and everybody that works for a living is in the same class. So we shouldn't see ourselves separate from that. But it's been easy to do, and of course there's a price to pay for that. I suppose one of the questions you probably ask most is who done it, and I like the way you wove it all together to show how the pressure was brought to bear on the little people, of course, who were associated in the fears and the apprehensions are very much the same as now when we see so much of our country operating from a fear and apprehensive position. Could you speak to that?
No, you're absolutely right. The killers were small-time hoods, and one of them, his only criminal offense before was drinking in public. So what they did is they recruited people for the three killers for cut-rate prices. One of them only got $1,000, which he spent almost immediately. But these were people who basically been displaced when the coal mines in the 50s, as Lewis agreed to increase mechanization in exchange for the coal operators paying more into the union's pension fund. But that led to about 3 million people having to flee Appalachia. And what they did is a lot of them went north. They went to Cleveland, they went to Akron, they went to Detroit for low-level factory jobs. And you either adjusted to that rhythm or you didn't. And these three guys didn't. One was a house painter. The other two were small-time thieves. So they were hardly professional killers. They were desperate themselves. It doesn't absolve their horrific actions. But, yeah, these were not the top-run killers. This wasn't the professional hitman by a long shot. And that's why they were, one of the reasons why they were rounded up so quickly.
Yeah. Mark, we certainly appreciate you sharing with our listeners the gist of this very significant labor history event. Before we sign off, could you tell our listeners where they can find your book?
Let's hope they can find it in most of your independent local bookstores. If not, there's always Amazon, and then there's Barnes and Noble, too. But it's gotten pretty good distribution across the country.
Yes, indeed. We're certainly glad we could chat with you about it, and glad that you illuminated this event, and because I would strongly recommend it for not just those interested in labor history, but for those who are just interested in a good story. And this was a gripping story, and you put it together so skillfully. So, Mark, I want to thank you for being on the Heartland Labor Forum with us tonight and sharing your insights and your skills with our listening audience.
No, Michael, it's been my pleasure. And again, I'm so grateful to have been invited on. So thank you and have a great holiday season.
My father said, and here's what he said to me, there is no disgrace in standing side by side with working people, sweating for an honest wage.
Listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI.
Clarksville, Pennsylvania is not too far from here. Coal miners were hoping for a brighter new year. But for Jockey Blonsky, his daughter and wife, the new year brought an ending to their precious life. Well, it's cold-blooded murder, friends, I'm talking about now. Who's gonna stand up and who's gonna fight? Trash keeps the working man down. Well, death bells were ringing. Jock knew very well that stolen union money, and Jock just had to tell. 'Cause he wouldn't take part in their dirty plans. Well, he paid with his life to help all mining men. Well, it's cold-blooded murder, friends, I'm talking about. Now, who's gonna stand up and who's gonna fight?
Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1971. That was the day that Namibian workers began a general strike to protest the contract labor system. As a colony of South Africa until 1990, Namibia faced many of the same apartheid-like measures that blacks faced in South Africa. Black migrant workers in Namibia comprised the majority of workers in the diamond mines, fisheries, and commercial farms. They were forced to live in the northern third of the country and were subjected to the pass system. The pass system determined where they could live and work and when they could travel. Restrictions on their rights as workers were directly tied to restrictions they experienced as colonial subjects. Because there were no trade unions at the time, this strike is considered to be an important first step in the 20-year fight for independence. More than 13,500 black contract workers participated, effectively shutting down 23 key workplaces and 11 mines. The indigenous Ovambo and Kavango workers demanded the right to choose jobs and contracts to bring their families to distant work locations, a new pass system, and increased wages based on work type, not skin color. In her book, Labor and Democracy in Namibia, Gretchen Bauer says that while workers did win wage increases, the pass system remained largely intact. Employers were angry that workers now had the right to bid on jobs, quit at will, and receive holiday bonuses and leave pay. Workers were upset that they were still subjected to restrictions of movement and arbitrary arrest and detention. But the strike began the long process of eroding the pass system, contract labor, and second-class citizenship for the indigenous workers of Namibia. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
He must know something, but don't say nothing. He just keeps rolling. He keeps on rolling along. He don't plant taters. He don't plant cotton. Them that plant some is soon forgotten. But old man River, he just keeps rolling along. You and me, we sweat and strain. Body all aching and racked with pain. Tote that barge, lift that bale. Show a little grit and your land's in jail. But I keeps laughing instead of crying. I must keep fighting until I'm dying. And old man River, he'll just keep rolling along.
That's it for this week's edition of Labor History Today. You can subscribe to LHT on your favorite podcast app, and even better, you can like it there and pass it along. Really appreciate that. Our thanks this week to Saul Schneiderman for bringing us and reading The Cafeteria Workers Organize a Union by Marcella Pope. The interview with Mark Bradley about his book Blood Runs Cold came to us from the Heartland Labor Forum, Kansas City's only program about the workplace. Radio that talks back to the boss, the Heartland Labor Forum airs Thursdays at 6 p.m. and Fridays at 5 a.m. Central Time on KKFI 90.1 FM, Kansas City Community Radio. You can find it on the Labor Radio Podcast Network, our website at laborradionetwork.org, where you'll also find Labor History in 2. Our music this week was Joe Hill and Old Man River by Paul Robeson. We couldn't find any recordings of his concert for the cafeteria workers, but these versions are from an impromptu concert on November 9, 1960, when Robeson sang for the workers at Sydney Opera House in Australia. Labor History Today is a member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network, working people's voices broadcasting worldwide 24 hours a day. You can find out more at laborradionetwork.org, where there are links to almost 80 labor radio and podcast shows. Labor History Today is produced by the Metro Washington Council's Union City Radio and the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown University. The Labor History Today team includes Ben Blake, Patrick Dixon, Leon Fink, Sherry Lincoln, Joe McCartan, Evan Papp, Jessica Pozak, and Alan Weirdak. For Labor History Today, this has been Chris Garlock. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and healthy, but do keep making history, and see you next time.
In Salt Lake City, Joe says I am standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I ain't dead. Says Joe, but I ain't dead. And standing there as big as life and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they can never kill, went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where working men defend their rights, it's there you'll find Joe Hill. It's there you'll find Joe Hill.